Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 393rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm the Director of Program and Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada and a professor at the University of Alberta. And today, we have with us another faculty from the University of Alberta. Drumroll. Tina.
Hi, good morning. So my name is Tina Kronik. I am an associate professor at the Department of Family Medicine here at the University of Alberta.
And Tina, you've been itching to talk to us about CPAP.
I have been, yes. Yeah. Anxiously awaiting.
And you have your entire family on CPAP right now, right? As a preventative?
Yeah, I truly believe in prevention. So
yeah, and your children, they're ages 4 and up, right?
Yeah.
So it's better to start early.
Yeah.
So
keep them quiet.
It's a CPAP room. They push pressure into the room. But anyway, we digress as always. But we're going to talk about a tools for practice that you guys just did on CPAP, because this is a fairly common thing that I'm sure you're asked about, or issues to deal with, the issue of, does CPAP do anything? Because there's a lot of, fair amount of research out there, and you guys have sort of put it all together.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, because you're right. It comes up frequently in our clinic. We actually are visited by there's lots of CPAP clinics that are abounding around where we are, and we're visited by reps from them frequently, sort of promoting the benefits of them. And often when patients are struggling with all sorts of things, so depression, insomnia, hypertension, CPAP is something that's sort of recommended down the line to us as something we should investigate with our patients.
And so now we're going to sort of go over all of the evidence, at least in regards to the whole aspect of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. So this topic came up through one of our medical students, and one of the things we learn about in medical school is that CPAP will reduce blood pressure and also reduces cardiovascular events. That's what I was taught anyways. So the understanding that if I have patients who are at risk, something like CPAP might be beneficial in helping to reduce cardiovascular events. So that's why in the last couple of years, there's been at least 3 systematic reviews that have been published. There's been a couple of really large-scale RCTs that have been completed looking at this very question. So does the use of CPAP in patients who may be at higher risk, does it actually reduce cardiovascular events? And just before all of this data came up, there was actually a number of observational studies. And so you're familiar with this pattern. So lots of observational studies that come out that suggest that people who are using CPAP compared to cohorts who don't tend to have less cardiovascular disease. So obviously there can be some adherence sort of bias and selection there, that those who are using it might be just compliers in life. Yeah. So these RCTs and
I was going to say, and I'm pretty sure there are cohorts showing that sort of obstructive sleep apnea does have some associations, I think, with cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
Sort of that logic that because they have that and it's increased cardiovascular disease, if we reduce it, we'll get rid of that cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. Yeah, really. Yeah. So it's kind of a fascinating area, right? That again, that theory that, and it has been shown if you have, sleep apnea, you may be at increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Is that from the sleep apnea or is it from the other things that are present in your life that put you at higher risk that we're not totally sure about? Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating that we always jump to the conclusion that there's causation involved rather than that these things are just traveling together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly.
We almost have to assume that causation is happening versus what is far more common, that they're just traveling together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and that really applies to so many things. I mean,
yeah.
We've talked it over the other 392 podcasts, and that's why it's so important to look at these sort of clinical trials, even though, you can argue that, not RCTs have their own level of bias and problems and blah blah blah. So, but anyway, so what did you guys find?
Okay, so there was what I like about this tool is there was three systematic reviews that all essentially came to a similar conclusion, which, you know, it tells you it might actually be the correct conclusion, or it's not as controversial. And they largely based on, there's a large randomized controlled trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2016 asking this question. When you look at the systematic reviews that have been published, overall, they're generally looking at patients who were male, mean age about 60 years of age, with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea. And so primary outcomes looking at cardiovascular disease, there's no difference between those patients who received CPAP or those who had either control or some type of sham treatment. I'm not sure exactly how the sham treatment was set up, but no difference in cardiovascular disease. And that was seven trials looking at over 4,000 patients. Similarly, if you look at outcomes with regards to cardiovascular death, no difference or benefit with the CPAP group or acute coronary syndrome or stroke. So you sort of see this consistency with the results that they don't seem to have a significant benefit in patients who are randomized to CPAP.
As far as the how long they do this thing, there's a fair amount of variability, I think, in the duration.
Yeah, and actually, so that's exactly, James. So that's one of the things I found the most interesting. When you look at how long patients use the CPAP at night, in the different trials, it ranged anywhere from 1.4 hours to about 5.8 hours per night at a year, so at a year's duration. It's pretty fascinating if you think of this controlled trial with, you know, the supports available and the education the patients would receive, that you still have patients, you know, on average, it's about 3 to 4 hours a night that they're using this, which fits really well with the practical experience I've had with a number of patients. And again, it's not always, this is just the mean. So there'll be patients who are outside of this on both sides. But I do have a number of patients who come in and say, oh, I can't tolerate it more than an hour or two, or, you know, it wakes me up. And I used to really encourage them, well, you know what, just, you know, get a mask that fits better, find a way to make this work. And it's kind of reassuring to me to see that even in these well-designed like trials where they have all the supports and access to all of those resources, they're still using it about 3 to 4 hours at most at night.
Yeah. And as far as how long were they were getting it, what, for a year or two, or it varied, right?
Yeah, so the trials that they included, you had to have follow the patients for at least 12 weeks. So the range was anywhere from 12 weeks, you know, and they followed them up to a year. So there's certainly a range there. And so some would say, yeah, are we going to be able to see dramatic improvement in cardiovascular outcomes within that short duration? And that's a fair question for sure. Do you need, you know, longer trials to look at that, perhaps?
Yeah, although if you look at the baseline rate, I mean, they're in the studies, you know, you're looking at over that period of time, whatever time it was that they were being studied, you're looking at, you know, rates in the sort of the 8, 9, 10%. So,
yep.
You know, it's not like you're looking at a group that never has cardiovascular events. They are clearly are having them. So, you know, hopefully they're designed long enough that they should be able to answer that question at least, or at least have some suggestion of benefit.
Yeah.
And these things are the study results, Tina, that you guys presented. It's not like there's a signal happening that things could be occurring. The acute coronary syndrome was 3% in both groups. Stroke was 4%. The CVD was 7 versus 8%. So you might think, oh, maybe something is happening there. But when you look at cardiovascular death, it was 9% versus 8. So even a tiny bit higher with CPAP. So there's just not a lot of promising information coming from this. And I agree with what you said about your practical experience. I've had a number of patients try this, and I remember when it first became popular or known in medicine, and we used to chase a lot of patients down and try and get them into sleep programs and all of this to get diagnosed. And so many of them, they were kind of like the early hearing aids where people were keen to try it out, and the minute they tried it, they didn't like it.
Yeah.
And so there's, as you mentioned, I have a handful of patients or had a handful of patients who absolutely swore by it and loved it, but a lot got it and used it 2 to 3 times and then gave up on it.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, it's great to have these long-term trials, but, you know, I would imagine most people are not actually using it because it might have this wonderful cardiovascular benefit. I mean, they're probably using it for a variety of symptomatic reasons. So, you know, even though this is neutral, if there were other benefits, then it might be worth doing.
Right. And so I think you looked at that, Tina, some of that other
stuff. Yeah. And I think it's such an excellent point, James, that most people aren't, you know, as we say in many things, they're likely not using it to reduce their cardiovascular benefits in many cases. But me as a clinician, that was one of the reasons I was really encouraging patients to continue on with it, even if they were finding it somewhat uncomfortable or wasn't improving their quality of life.
Yeah, which is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, you know,
it is. But
and you are a very nice person and a great doctor from everything I've heard, and that was primarily from you.
Well,
sometimes it's so difficult to stand back. I'm sure we've all experienced this. Well, you know, just keep taking your statin, keep taking your blood pressure medication.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, you don't feel very good on it, don't worry, it'll get better. And it doesn't. And then it's just a really interesting process.
Keep taking your aspirin. I know you're bleeding.
Yes.
Just keep taking it.
Yeah, but
you're going to thank me if you survive.
Yeah, remember, you used to be bleeding from 10 spots in your body. We're now down to 5.
Exactly.
Another success story.
Yeah. So to the question about, and again, we wanted to look at, you know, what is the evidence in all aspects. If you look at outcomes like daytime sleepiness, so there are RCTs that have recorded sleepiness as an outcome, and it does show a statistically significant improvement in sleepiness, ranging from about 1.6 to 3.8 points on a 24-point scale. Often they use this Epworth sleepiness scale, which is 24 points. So, you know, maybe up to 4 points at best. And if we look at what is sort of clinically detectable, it seems that, you know, 3 to 4 points would be within the range of clinically detectable. So in certain patients, yeah, they may actually see an improvement in sleepiness, and that is actually clinically detectable. And then if you look at other quality of life measures, again, they have been shown to be statistically significantly improved by about 3.3 to almost 10 points on a 100 point scale. Most of those scales don't really have a clear minimal clinically important difference. And again, that would be your mean improvement. So you'd likely have some patients with a bit more improvement and some with less. And then there's observational data looking at motor vehicle accidents. So again, this is just observational. So again, you're going to have that selection bias, but those patients who opted to use the CPAP versus those who didn't seem to have a significant reduction in accidents, actually. And that was the one thing I mentioned their large RCT published in the New England Journal that did almost 3,000 patients. They suggested this sort of trend towards reduction in motor vehicle accidents, although it wasn't statistically significant. So there are some, you can argue, some observational evidence, maybe a trend towards improvement in those outcomes.
Yeah. And that's the problem. I'm sure that wasn't the primary endpoint. And so they're looking at a lot of things. And like you said, it's a p-value, that dreaded p-value of 0.06.
Yeah. You know,
that sends shivers up and down the spines of all researchers.
Yeah.
But
damn, if we had gone one day more.
Yeah, if we'd just had one more patient who would have had an accident.
Yeah.
go in there. This guy's not on CPAP. Go hit him in the parking lot.
Exactly. Doesn't matter if it has no association. So with all of this, I mean, this is, you know, as much evidence at least as we have to date, and I would imagine, you know, with the largest trial being published in New England Journal of Medicine and outcomes and all that, I doubt that there's probably going to be another one being done in a hurry. I've not looked to see if there are any, but you know, it gives us reasonably, you know, as I look at this sort of stuff, that it goes, you know, if you don't feel better on it, it doesn't seem like there's much of a reason to use it. Is that sort of where you guys are with this?
That's exactly where I am. And interesting, just that question of, you know, how long should I try it until I feel better? Some observational studies tried to sort of look at where does the benefit occur. And, you know, they said, we can't tell for sure, but it seems that there may be benefit after one night. So if it's helping you sleep, you're probably going to feel better pretty quickly, which I thought made sense. So that trial, and if, because some patients say, yeah, this has changed my life, that's fabulous. But if they're coming in and saying they don't like it, then I say, well, you're done. You don't, yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd probably give more, like I said, I'm sure you would, more than one night just to get used to the whole thing. But I think you're right. If you're not seeing a benefit within, you know, trying it over a week, you know, it's not all of a sudden going to get tremendously, you know, a lot better.
No.
So, exactly. So some of the providers will allow you to almost like borrow equipment to see if you like it, which I think is a great idea, because all of the costs with this are quite high. So if you can kind of borrow to figure out if you're actually going to be able to use it. And then many of the places too will try and say things like, well, maybe the mask isn't fitting right, maybe the pressure's turned up too high, maybe the moisture's collecting more on yours, etc. So they'll come and make adjustments, but certainly after those kind of things are tried and you haven't gotten anywhere, as crazy as it seems, let the patient make a decision. And I know that's crazy. Sorry, James.
Given that you've now moved to BC, you've now, you know, your attitude has changed. In Alberta, it was take everything that I'm telling you to do and never question it.
It was doctor-centered medicine there.
Yeah, yeah.
Doctor-centered medicine. Particularly Mike-centered medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's really interesting. No. I mean, we have so many treatments like this that go around and around in circles until we start to get some of the evidence. And it is surprising how often it doesn't work nearly as well. And I think, you know, you can go back and again and listen to most of our podcasts. There are clearly things that do have an effect. There are some very useful treatments, but we got to realize that not a lot of these things work nearly as well as we sometimes think, especially when they haven't been studied effectively.
Right, exactly.
And we might need to be more selective about who we're using them in, right? I suspect that there's subgroups of people that we aren't quite refined in identifying ahead of time that will benefit, because Tina and I have people in our practice who swear by this stuff and others who hated it.
Yeah.
And certainly the ones that are on the borderline, I have, like, the ones that are profoundly, you know, I'm falling asleep behind the wheel, I can't watch any TV shows with my family or movies with my family, I fall asleep immediately. Those kind of patients are, you know, I would hazard to guess that maybe they get more benefit. But,
I don't know, maybe the ones where you push them to give it a reasonable trial.
Yeah, yeah, and, exactly.
And, you know, give the expectation that it's up to them to figure out if it works. And if it does, you know, then we come across as geniuses. If not, we go, huh, well, it's the patient's fault.
Yeah, that's always to blame. Yeah.
So anything, go ahead. No, go ahead, Tina.
Oh, I was just going to say that there's a couple. The other thing I thought was really interesting, which I hadn't heard before, was there was actually a systematic review looking at lifestyle interventions for obstructive sleep apnea. And again, while some diverse interventions, really it was aerobic and resistance exercise 2 to 3 times a week, also reduced the sleepiness scale by about 3 points out of 24. So it was actually better than some of the RCTs. Again, just that idea. It's really hard to motivate people for lifestyle changes, but lifestyle is as good as, if not better than the evidence in some of the trials around sleepiness and quality of life outcomes. So just again, to put it, you know, back into the basket of things that are hard to modify, that was really interesting. And the other thing I should just bring up quickly, in the meta-analysis, two of them did subgroup analysis, and then the subgroup analysis, if you look at patients who adhered to the machine for 4 hours or more, they found a significant benefit. However, you have to be careful just how that's reported, because there's so many outcomes. If you actually do like a p-value for interaction, and it's not significant anymore. So some people will argue maybe you just need to use it longer. But I think, again, those, when you're doing that subgroup analysis, that's not a randomized group. You're just looking at patients who adhered or could tolerate it for 4 hours or longer.
And they may be fundamentally different people and all of that sort of issue associated with it. Yeah, no. So, I mean, this is pretty much, I mean, again, as you guys these tools of practices are always so well done, and we'll definitely post a link to this tools of practice, and it's got all the numbers, all of the evidence, and so on. And I think hopefully, you know, this, I'm sure when you guys went through it, it impacted to some degree your practice, and that's kind of why we do all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, Tina, it had a big impact on how I address this issue with my patients, for sure.
And Tina, who did this one with you? Was it Peter, I think?
Yeah, so Peter Yang, he's a medical student, also a pharmacist who's gone into medicine. He's a super awesome, smart guy. So yeah, he worked on this one with me. Yeah,
cool. So any other words of wisdom on CPAP? Apparently not. So let's remind people that they will get many, many words of wisdom at the PIPE conference, which is coming up.
At the PIPE conference on October 19th and 20th in lovely Edmonton.
Yeah. So yeah, all the usual suspects will be there.
Yeah, that's right. We tried to exclude James, but he found a way to come anyway.
Yeah. As always. Although the fact that you gave me the 3 a.m. talk is a bit disconcerting.
In the parking lot.
In the parking lot. And on another note, because you guys are so rude, we also have a course in Vancouver coming up. That will be May 3 and May 4. And we still haven't invited anyone yet to it. And I'm thinking we may not.
Yeah, October 19 and 20th, and the schedule is all out. We're waiting for registration, and if you want to do that from home, we also have a webcast, which is generally quite successful and well done. So
yeah, excellent. So and make sure you check out our website for all the stuff that we're doing. We regularly publish stuff, and whenever we do, we actually usually talk about it on the podcast. And we will continue to bring you tools for practice, and hopefully you found this information useful. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.